Our lessons this summer have been less contiguous than normal, and that's because we did a wedding, we did a camp out, we had some guest speakers, and so consequently, we didn't put them right next to each other, so I decided to make them all individual lessons. However, there has been a theme around them, and we're going to pick up on that theme. This not being contiguous, however, there won't be a sense of flow. These will just be some things that were left over in my files that I hadn't got to this summer that I want to get to. So I'm going to review a little bit of what we said because you might have forgotten from Memorial Day to now, and then I'm going to make a little bit of application of the things that we've been talking about. At the beginning of the summer, I did a lesson titled Oneness versus Two-ness. In it, I touched on a theme that I've been emphasizing a lot lately, and that is this, that at the core of our spiritual lives, at the center of our religious thought and practice, there is God. And how we think of God is powerfully determinative of everything that comes next. How we think about ourselves is rooted in how we think of God. How we think of one another, rooted in our view of God. How we think about Iraqis and Afghanis, how we think about and how we react to gay people and to straight people, or Republicans, or Democrats, or toxic family members, all of these things that create physical responses and emotional responses and mental responses, all the stimuli to which we react and respond is determined by some core beliefs we have about reality. And at the core of the core, at the center of our sense of ultimacy, there is God. And we've said there is an axiom, truth that we become like the God we worship. Now, everybody's got a God. Even atheists who say they have no God, using our definition, there is something that they experience as bedrock, something we all experience as that framing reality at the center of who we are. For some, it might be the scientific method or the power of the human mind to inquire, but we have something in which we put our faith, something that gives meaning to our experience. And so we, as Christian people, are revisiting some of the common conceptions that we have of God because of that axiom that we become like the God we worship. If our God is angry, we unconsciously begin to normalize anger. And it's not long after we have normalized anger that we simply become angry. If our God is punitive, the same process unfolds. If our God is a hypocrite that offers loving words up front, but in the end serves up violence and punishment, well then, we tend to normalize hypocrisy. We certainly don't call it hypocrisy. We frame it to be some other thing in our minds, but soon we normalize it. And it's not long after we've done that that the net effect is that we become hypocrites. So, it becomes important on our spiritual journeys to think keenly, to be watchful of the God that we embrace, to think about it as deeply as we can. Who is it? What is it? What is the divine that we reverence? And at this moment in our nation's history, it is a sad observation that large numbers of Christians have lost our moral centers. We've lost our ethical way. We've lost our spiritual sight. And when this happens, it's a good idea to backtrack, to go back and see where it was that we got lost, to go back to the center, back to the beginning. And the beginning is God. If we become like the God that we revere, and if we have become something that we do not want to be, it's a good idea to ask ourselves where we went wrong. What is it that we believe about God? And so this summer, I've been asking you to question some of the common Christian assumptions about God and to think more broadly in terms of historical understandings of God, biblical understandings of God, and a way that we can think differently. So I suggested to you that if we consider all of our Christian texts, we end up finding trouble with this model. You'll remember this from Memorial Day. If you missed that lesson, by the way, you can go online and be caught up. I suggested that the idea that God is outside of us, and that when God wants to come and intervene in our lives, God must move from not here over to here. And when that happens, then there can be an intersection between the divine and the realm of everything in which we live. And inside the realm of everything, there is me and there is you, and we are distinct entities. And God, being outside of this reality of everything, comes and intervenes. And there are a lot of biblical texts that reinforce these fundamental assumptions. There's a lot of things that we grew up with that reinforce these fundamental assumptions. And that is, in many ways, the reality, the lens that we have on that when we go to look at our spiritual lives, when we go look at life, we make these assumptions. You'll recall that. But I said, if we listen to all of our texts, not just the ones that make sense to us because we have this lens on when we look at them, if we look at all of our texts, there is a theme that goes throughout Scripture and throughout history that speaks among the spiritual masters who have intuited a different understanding long ago, that tell us that we are connected to God in a way that this model doesn't picture. That God is in us and we are of God. God is in everything and everything is of God. And we said that there is a way of thinking about reality in which God is as much inside of us as outside of us, and that we are connected to one another in this collective whole, and we are connected to the divine in this collective whole, and we are connected to everything, and everything is connected to us. So again, if you missed that lesson, oneness versus two-ness, you should listen online. And then last week, I suggested that as we're trying to deal with the images that are in our minds of God, if we take this concept and begin to import it into and inform these images that we carry around about God, it causes us to think a little more broadly about these visceral images that we carry around. We talked about how fruitful an image it is to think of God in human-like terms, but how also it's very limited and often will get us into trouble. The parent-child image of God is very rich in meaning. The lover-beloved image of God is very rich in meaning, as is the king-subject, mother-child, or the pursuit of the maiden Sophia that is laid out in the book of Proverbs. But when we allow ourselves only to think of God with person-like traits, when we miss some of the broader themes of spiritual reality, we get hung up on some, sometimes even toxic assumptions about the nature of God. Toxic assumptions because we limit God to fitting only in these human-like traits. So, again, you can listen about some of those problems last week. But one of the things that we talked about last week is thinking of God as soil instead of Superman. The ground of being is the term that the Christian spiritual masters have used. The soil in which we are irrevocably rooted. The always presence from which we sustain our being. This kind of view of God creates some different questions, we said. What are the nutrients in the soil? And I suggested some last week. What kinds of spiritual instincts kick in when we have this different kind of image? What are the things that are evoked? If God is soil, always in me and me in it, always around me, then mine becomes a spiritual quest to experience what already is, as opposed to this plea to a distant being that is somehow far away to come over and intervene on my behalf. I begin to think about awakening to what is already within me, what is always around me, as opposed to going and getting something that is not here. Rooted in the divine soil, present to the presence in the present, I see myself differently. I see the divine differently. And lo and behold, I begin to see you differently. We are of the same crop, the same soil, irremovably connected to God, irremovably connected to one another, together rooted, together the same stalk and stem. And as we saw the first week, Jesus' idea that we love all, that we love our neighbors. And then he expands who's the neighbor and expands it all the way out to include enemies. That whole construct that seems just completely senseless and absurd doesn't make sense unless I realize that at some dimension of reality, I am you and you are me. We are expressions of the same reality. This before could not make sense, but when I think in terms of this connectedness that our scriptures consistently allude to, we realize that I can't live in a world in which I win and you don't. That world doesn't work. I can't thrive if you don't thrive. I can't flourish if you're not flourishing. That makes sense in a oneness. So my love for you becomes a part of this reality of the connected world in which we live. Now, it is true that for a short time, I can win at your expense. And it's true that for a short time, I can thrive while others don't. But that's an unsustainable reality that doesn't work over the long haul. And our model points to that, that we see every day. So, well, if we are a oneness instead of a two-ness, and if we are connected, well, then our fates are joined, and I have a vested interest in you thriving just as I thrive. So that's a quick review. Today I want to talk a little bit about what it means in our lives. What is the story that gets associated with this kind of framework? And I want to tell you two stories that happened this week, and they will help us see how these abstract ideas about the nature of God shape both the God we revere and the lives that we live on the basis of that God. So there's a young man in our community that came to talk with me this week who got his dream job after getting out of college, and you know that people getting out of college these days, getting any job is a big deal, and he didn't just get any job, he got his dream job. He's heading off to Central America, where he's going to work with an organization that is combating human trafficking, and he's as excited as can be, but he's also a little bit apprehensive. And the apprehensive part went something like this. What's going to happen to me, Doug, when I go to confront true evil? What happens to my innocence? He said, I know I've lived a sheltered life, and I know I've lived a good life, and I'm a little concerned about what happens to me when I go to deal with the devil, when I go to deal with the slave trafficker, when I go and immerse my life in this kind of evil. I'm a little concerned about what happens to the human soul in that kind of confrontation. And so we talked a little bit about what the job would be like, talked about where he was going to find a girlfriend. We talked about all the kinds of things that people talk about. And after we had just kind of put some texture to what this big life change was going to be like, I came back and I brought up the question, what happens to us when we encounter true evil? And so to help us in our conversation, I didn't draw this drawing for him, but I asked him a series of questions, and it's a little bit unfair. They're rhetorical questions because he's been in the lessons. He's heard what we're talking about. But I said, is your God distinct, an entity apart from you? Is your God somewhere far away from you, having to come from not here over to here in order to effect good and resist evil? Does your God work from some distant staging place that is way over there? And if so, has your God come from all the way over there to take up residence inside of you, but because your enemy has not prayed the prayer that you have, has your God not come all the way from over there to here to inhabit him? Is that your God? And is that the human condition that you live in? And are these the circumstances into which you step when you go down to take on this job that is indeed a mission to face evil? And he paused for a moment and he said, well, you know, I kind of know the answer because I've been to all the lessons. However, kind of, yeah, that's exactly how it feels. And I said, well, that's what happens to us when we're in the midst of transitional thinking. When we're going from one way of viewing reality to another way of viewing reality, we might have ideas in our head, but in our guts, that's exactly what we feel like. So I said, so let's just go with that for a moment. Let's think about what comes next in this mission of yours, this job of yours, if we think about that way. So I said, if this is your God, and if this is your reality, you should know that you are in good company. Because there are a lot of people and a lot of organizations and a lot of nations who have this very idea about their enemies. Lots of armies are marshaling lots of tax dollars to go and to face down evil. And they've got God in their minds on their side. They are on the side of God. They are on the side of good. And the enemy is on the side of evil. And theirs is a holy mission to go and to stop evil, to catch the evil people, to imprison them, to stop them, and to punish them. And if that is your God, and if that is the human condition in which you operate, well, then you are in good company. Because that is how most people think about reality. You will function in that worldview according to a different set of views than we might suggest, but here's what will come to your mind. You will have one way of thinking about your enemy, and it will be this. Your enemy must disgust you, because your enemy is the embodiment of all that is wrong with humanity. And that very sense of disgust will motivate you, because you will be able, on the basis of being revolted at your enemy's debased heart, to rise up in the sense of righteous indignation and go and confront that which is wrong. You must be appalled by his disregard for the most fundamental and basic principles of human decency, and you must see your enemy as other than yourself. He is surely not cut from the same cloth that you are cut. He is not you. He is on the side of evil. He is the slave trafficker. And you are good. You are a modern-day abolitionist. And, I said, you can approach the next few years down there just this way, and again, you will be in good company. Yours will actually be the majority of opinion. That will be the way most people think. But I said there is an alternative, and that is you could start with a different worldview. You could start with a different God, the God we've been talking about, a God that is in you and in the world and in the other, a God that is connected to everything and to whom everything is connected, a God that is part of a whole system in which everything is interconnected, you and slave trader included, where you could see that you are not only connected to the victimized, connected to the enslaved, but you are also connected to the enslaver, rooted in the same divine presence that the slave trader is rooted in. And you could see yourself carrying around the same intrinsic preciousness that he does. In some true way, he is you, and you are him, which means that you are not free until he is free. And you do not thrive until both slave and slave trader thrive. And neither will thrive as long as this horrible practice continues. And I said, if this is your perspective, it's going to profoundly change your instincts about what you do. You're going to approach your job very differently. You're going to approach your policies very differently. You're going to have different kinds of instincts. The question before you will be a lot about where do you spend your budget dollars? Are your budget dollars spent punitively, seeking out, capturing, punishing the slave trader? Well, perhaps there's a place for that and a time for that, but you need to understand why you would come to those instincts. Or shall your dollars be spent raising a community's consciousness, helping a whole culture see differently? Traders, victims, bystanders, all part of a connected whole, all needing to have the consciousness of our humanity raised, helping them all see the intrinsic preciousness of human beings, helping them see the connected preciousness of all. And we talked a little bit about poppy seed or poppy farmers in some of the parts of Afghanistan that have no other cash crop except opiates. And we said, if we think of ourselves as disconnected from the farmer, then we come in and we just put spray all over their poppies, and we think that we have won and they have lost. But if we think of ourselves as a connected whole, we realize that we don't thrive until the farmer thrives, until there's some other way of thinking about that farmer raising a cash crop. And if we don't take care of the farmer, there will be another way to get those drugs raised. There will be another way to do cash crop. Until we see our fortunes intertwined as a connected part of a oneness, we can't think comprehensively about solving this problem. We can't be free of those drug imports if he can't feed his family. And it is part of a connected oneness. And so I said, you, I told him, are going in to a society that has a different consciousness than the one that you were raised in. You were born into a society that has already fought a battle to raise consciousness about enslaving people. So you inherited a gift that you did not earn. A society that gave you a truth from your childhood. You have known from the time you were born that one person enslaving another is evil. And I said that many other people in many other societies have not been given that gift. And they see themselves as so disconnected that it is reasonable in their minds to assume that women can be thought of in the same category as cattle. That one group can believe itself to be free while enslaving another. That one can believe himself immune while victimizing another. And I said, deceived as that culture may be, and as evil as that deception is, when we see ourselves as disconnected from it, we have one response. But when we see ourselves as part of the connected system, we have another. When we see ourselves in a oneness with that system, our instincts and responses and policies are very different. Jesus taught us that it is truth. Truth that sets us free. And if you go down there thinking that your innocence will be assaulted by the embodiment of evil, it will never even occur to you that truth is a tool of freeing slaves and slave traders. Now, all that being said, I told him, it is quite possible that many people in a society can become so resistant to truth that enforcement is the only tool you have available in order to change behavior. Before a heart can change and a behavior can change, there must be a pry bar that comes in. So it is possible that a cultural system can be so locked in upon itself that it will take harsh measures to pry it free, and violent confrontation may become a necessary strategy. But when our starting place is that God is out there and comes to visit me, but does not come to visit my enemy, when our starting place is that I am completely different from my enemy, it doesn't even occur to us to consider the possibility that the sickness in the system might be healed. But on the other hand, if our starting place is that we are rooted in the same divine presence that the slave trader is rooted in, then Jesus' words about loving our enemies makes sense. But only when we realize that in some way I am my enemy and my enemy is me. And I said, if that is your starting place, then violent confrontation will be a little bit like cutting off your own foot. It comes as a last resort. We only cut off our own foot if it has become gangrenous and it threatens our entire body. And if that has to happen, it is a tragic day, a necessary but tragic day, the day to be mourned that the foot could not be restored to its rightful place, that the plant has become so diseased it has to be uprooted. And I said, the God that you worship will determine what instincts you bring to bear when you go in to take on this mission that is now set before you. Now you're going off to save people's lives, to confront a system of enslavement and abuse. And the God that you take with you is going to be powerfully deterministic in the instincts you bring to your mission. So, think deeply about your God. And as well, how we think about our gods. The way that we imagine God is going to be just as deterministic in how we run our lives. Now, the second time this week that I saw how our view of God affects our instincts happened in our conflict resolution training on Wednesday evening. Most times when people come to put some energy and effort into resolving a conflict, that energy and effort is geared up to help us win. We come for the purpose of making sure I get justice. We come to make sure that I get fairness. They come to make sure that I get respected, that I am not misunderstood, and that I am not mistreated, and that I get what is rightfully mine, that I get what is fair, that I get what is just. And when we put our energies into that system, it works a lot of times. It really does. But the reason it works a lot of times is most of the time we all are functioning together according to a shared set of assumptions and a shared set of agreed upon objectives. And when that happens, we are usually unconsciously working toward the well-being of the whole system. Even though it doesn't feel like that, we have framed ourselves to be working for the well-being of the whole process. And so it works. But it doesn't work because we are consciously going after fairness. It works because we are unconsciously working toward a set of systems and assumptions that work for the whole system. But then sometimes it doesn't work. And when it doesn't work, it really doesn't work. And so we keep applying the same practices and we keep applying the same instincts and we do it again and we do it again. And we tend to find out how badly it doesn't work. And as a result of that 5% or some number, we find ourselves just making sure that we keep ourselves at a distance from one another. Because if I get too close, if I'm too transparent, if we become too intimate, it's going to hit the fan. And I know where this is going to go. With no tools in place to work consciously toward the well-being of the whole, we simply keep ourselves at arm's distance from one another. So, what we're doing in the conflict resolution class is learning some tools to help us negotiate the well-being of the whole system. I'm looking to negotiate for the well-being of the network, of which you and I are both a part. I'm looking to find something that is good for you and for me. And as well for the kids and for the budget and any other part that's part of the system. It's not good for all, then it's not good for me. If it's not good for all, then it's not good for you. Now, sometimes people think that it is noble and Christian to give up and to let the other person win. But really, this is no more an effective strategy than it is to insist that we would always win. Because if I just let the other person win, sometimes I'm not being noble and virtuous, I'm just being cowardly. I'm unwilling to go there and fight for the well-being of the whole system, I'm just going to let this one slide. And if I don't work for the well-being of me, I'm not working for the well-being of the whole system. But if I'm only working for the well-being of me, then I'm not working for the well-being of the whole system. I'm not thinking comprehensively. I'm not thinking cohesively. I'm not thinking in a connected way. And so consequently, we must think in terms of tools to work toward the well-being of the whole. So that's what we're learning to do. We're learning techniques that over the course of this summer will teach us to be self-aware, to know what's going on in the system, to learn how to be self-disclosing so we can know what's really going on in all of the system. And then we realize that I'm working toward me thriving because we are all thriving. Me winning because we are all winning. Me prospering because we are all prospering. And I start to realize that it's only in the short run that the converse can be true. It's only in the short run that I can thrive if you do not. It's only in the short run that I can win if you do not. It's only in the short run that I can prosper if you do not. So we need to understand our own hidden motives so that we can disclose these discoveries in a safe and trusting way. And then we need to be informed by what the whole system is so we can work toward the well-being of the whole system. Well, y'all haven't seen it yet, but I promise that works. By the end of the summer, you will find, hey, I know how to resolve conflict right now. I don't have to be sitting here in this guarded, distant, non-intimate place, I can actually wade in there, and even if it hits the fan, I know how to get myself out of that process. So those are two illustrations that come from a way of thinking about God and a way of thinking about self and a way of thinking about the human condition that is different than the way we typically do. And I know that these are kind of jangling, uncomfortable thoughts to be thinking. To ask someone to move from this reality to this one is very uncomfortable. But I am asking you to think those thoughts. Because these are just two illustrations, but I hope you can see the bigger picture. Our instincts about God inform our instincts about living. Now, there are an infinite number of other expressions, other ways that we live this out, and they usually happen unconsciously, but they do affect us, and they diminish us, and they limit us. This is not a bad way of thinking about God. It's just not the only way of thinking about God. And there is another way of thinking about God as well. Both are rooted in history. Both are rooted in Scripture. Both are present in our tradition. And as we come to explore this, we're doing so primarily because we've ignored it for the last 1,000 years. So, that being said, let's think about the God we worship and get a better and better picture as we go. Spirit of God within us, open the eyes of our hearts that we may see divine light, that we may see divine life, that we may see our God, and that we may be transformed in that process. Be it so, Lord. In Jesus' name, amen.